Begin. See some new faces. What's your name?
I'm Davis.
How do you spell that? How do you spell that?
Mark,
yeah, that I got.
M-A-N-G.
M-A-N-G?
K-H-O.
H-O.
I-E-N.
How do you spell that?
I-E-N.
I-E-N?
E-N.
E-N. Marco Ian? Marco Ian? What? Yeah?
Marco Ian.
You'll correct me every time. I'll try to get it right. How do you say it again? Marco.
Marco
Ian. I'll try. Okay. Everyone else here? Oh, no. Another friend of theirs. Huh? Just over there. Okay. Welcome. The way we try to run this class is to quickly go through the parsha. We do a quick overview, and then we go through it again with more explanation. Does anyone mind if I turn on the air conditioner? Yeah. What do you do?
Are you hot?
Let's take a vote. Who wants the air conditioner on? Only one. Two. Okay, so we'll leave it off. Our parsha is called Parsha Shoftim. Literally means the parsha of judges. Parsha really doesn't have to do with the judges, only in the beginning, first few psukim. Parsha tells us to appoint judges, to appoint policemen, to make sure that we have a just law, and that the justice system is functioning justly. The laws are the laws of the Torah, but we have to make sure that the judges abide by them, and that we appoint just judges who are going to be just. The Torah then tells us a special mitzvah about avodah zarah, not planting certain types of idol worship, certain types of trees that were worshipped, and stones, not to establish stones for worship. The Torah tells us not to bring offerings before Hashem. When we bring offerings before God, we're not allowed to bring offerings that have certain blemishes. What happens if we find a person in our midst that decides to go and serve idols? So then the Torah says, if he was properly warned and we have correct testimony, then he gets killed. But did you ask something? Right, death penalty. The Torah then tells us what happens if we don't know what the law is regarding a certain issue. And we take it to the high court of the city, and they have different opinions and they can't reach a conclusion and they're not sure what the law is. So the Torah says we bring it up to the high court in Jerusalem, and that court gives a ruling. And the Torah tells us what happens if one of the rabbis decides not to abide by that ruling. If one of the rabbis says, I know the high court says that, but I disagree. The Torah then tells us the mitzvahs when we come to the land of Israel, that we have a mitzvah to appoint a king, and the limitations that a king has, not to amass too much wealth, not to take on too many wives, not to have too many horses. And he has to abide by the Torah. The Torah then tells us, we're holding by Shlishi, that the Kohanim and the Levim, the tribe of the Levites and the Kohanim, what would be translated probably as the priests, they don't have a section in the land. They don't inherit the land. And they get special gifts from the people. And then we have a warning about what I guess could be translated loosely as black magic, witchcraft. The nations of the time had all kinds of sorcerers and warlocks and witches. And anyone who studies history knows that that was a very, very potent part of the religious life of the neighboring nations. And that was one of the ways that the leaders held on to the people. In Egypt, for example, they worshipped the dead. Well, there was only one living God in Egypt. That was the Pharaoh. And that was one of the ways that they held on to the people, because he's the God, and he's going to decide what's going to happen to them when he hits the world to come. So that's why he could get all his people to invest in building these pyramids, because they wanted him to have a good afterlife. So one of the chief ways, opium of the masses, control the people was religion, and they had all kinds of ways of tricking the people. We're going to discuss whether any of these things really worked. Meaning the Torah relates to them. The Torah gives a long listing of different types of witchcraft, if we could call it that, and says we can't go with that. Well, was it all fake or was it not fake? So we'll discuss that when we get there. God tells us, I'm going to give you a prophet, and listen to the prophet. We have the special mitzvah, what happens if a person murders by mistake? He's in the middle of fixing his roof, he's out, and his trowel slips, something else, and someone gets killed. So there's a special law that he has to flee to one of the special cities of refuge called Ir Miklat in Hebrew. And the Torah tells us we have to set those up in the land of Israel. What happens if someone really hates someone's guts and then he happens to, by mistake, kill him? So we'll discuss that when we get there. The Torah also tells us what happens then. And then the Torah tells us, even though we have a prohibition on stealing, right? It's one of the Ten Commandments. There's another prohibition on extending boundaries. Like if you have land in Israel, you want to extend your boundary over into your neighbor's section a little bit. So there's a special prohibition on that, on top of the prohibition against stealing. The Torah establishes that our testimony has to be a testimony of two. We always need two witnesses, and then we have cross-examinations, etc. And then the Torah tells us when we go out to war, to expand our boundaries, so we have special laws. We anoint a special kohen, a special high priest, and he gives a special speech before the people, a pep talk and warnings, and that we'll discuss when we get there. The parsha ends with what we do when we conquer a city, how we're supposed to lay siege on a city, and what happens if suddenly in the middle of nowhere we find a dead man. So what do we do? Obviously we try to find out who killed him, but what happens when we don't succeed in finding out? So there's a special procedure called the procedure of Egla Arufa, the calf that's beheaded from the neck, that the Torah tells us to do, and we'll discuss what's done and why it's done when we get there. So now let's go over the parsha a little bit more in depth. Starting from the beginning again. The Torah tells us to appoint judges. We discussed on Sunday that the judicial system in Judaism is something that's integral to our well-being. It's not just a legal system. We mentioned once before that there's an integral difference between the Jewish legal system and any other legal system you'll see in the world. If you analyze all the legal systems today, we have the Bill of Rights in the United States, and the constitutions sometimes begin with, these are the inalienable rights of every man. The legal systems around the world stress me, or you. What are my rights? The legal systems stress, what do I deserve? And that's part of Western philosophy. The whole idea of government in Western philosophy is to protect the individual's rights. In Judaism, if you notice, the Torah, we have nowhere in the Torah that it says, your right is to this. Every constitution you look at says a person has a right to. He has a right to a judge, a jury. There are rights to his private property. The Torah doesn't work that way. The Torah begins by telling us what are our obligations. The Torah tells us this is what you have to do. Now, in every system, obviously, what are my rights are your obligations. If my right is that you can't steal my home, then your obligation is not to steal my home. If my right is that I could do what I like on my property, then your obligation is not to prevent me from doing that on my property. All the rights that we have are other people's obligations. In any system, take marriage. One can approach the system and say, well, I don't deserve this, and I do deserve that. So one can approach marriage and approach his wife and say, you know, you have to make me breakfast. You have to make my bed. You have to do the laundry. And the wife can walk in and say, yeah, well, you have to make sure I have a Porsche, and you have to make sure I have a fur coat. And many marriages look that way, and they don't look too good. Judaism stresses that our approach to life has to be, what are my obligations? We have a law regarding a slave. When a Jew buys another Jew sees that he can't make ends meet, so he says, I want to give up on life. Let someone else take care of me. I'll go into service for you. I'll be your servant. You feed me, you clothe me, you take care of me. So the halacha says, that the master has to treat the slave like his brother. Has to treat him like a brother. If there's only one bed, the servant gets it, the Jewish servant. If there's only one pillow, the servant gets it. He has to treat him very, very well. But the servant has to treat him like a master. So now what happens? The servant walks in and says, "Hey, I'm your brother, right?" And the master says, "No, you're my slave." That's not going to work. It only works if the master takes upon himself his obligation. He says, "Okay, I have to treat him like a brother." And he does his role. And he focuses on, what do I owe him? And the servant is going to focus on his role. What do I owe him? Then such a system could work. The same thing is true in marriage. Now, the Torah on the one hand stresses setting up the legal system, setting up the judges who are going to judge. On the other hand, we know that Chazal tell us that Jerusalem was destroyed because people maintained justice. So what does that mean? So Chazal tell us that the Torah gives us the minimum. What do I owe you? But the Torah expects us to do beyond what I owe you. Society can't function if we're constantly going to sue one another. This is what I deserve. I'm entitled to this much, and I don't owe you more than X, Y, or Z. Depending on a person's level, will depend on how much he has to go, what we call lifnim mishuras hadin, beyond the letter of the law. You have to go beyond that. It's not enough. But that's something that each person has to know for himself or ask his rabbi. The judges, their job is to keep the law. Chazal tell us that we have six sections in the Mishnah, right? We have Zraim, the laws of planting. We have Nashim, the laws that have to do with women. We have Nezikim, the laws that have to do with damages. So at the end of the laws of damages, we have tractate Pirkei Avos. The laws of our fathers, all kinds of ways, moral ways a person should run his life. The obvious question is, what does this have to do with the laws of damages? So Chazal tell us that our sages had in tradition, together with the Torah, all kinds of moral ways that a person has to function. You have to be kind. You have to give charity. There are a lot of things that it says in the Torah, and there are a lot of things that are the spirit of the law, but they're not written out in the Torah. Our sages saw that the students were learning the laws of damages, and they said, "Gee, I'm only responsible for this much or that much." And they weren't doing anything beyond that. So what they did was, they included in the laws of damages, in the Seder Nezikin, at the very end of it, you learn the laws of Pirkei Avos. How is a person supposed to be a mensch? How are you supposed to be a good person to society? It's not enough that we learn the laws, what do I owe? What do I owe you? But, the parsha begins with Shoftim and Shoftim. We have to establish judges, we have to establish policemen. Now, policemen were responsible to enforce the laws of the judges, and they were also responsible for going around the marketplaces and seeing that the weights were just, the people weren't cheating one another. They had to see that society was running smoothly. We have a special mitzvah to establish judges in every tribe and in every city. In the land of Israel, we have to establish more judges than outside Israel. Outside Israel, only cities of a certain size got judges. And in Israel also, other sized cities, they also got judges. The division was greater. You had more judges in Israel. Now, we discussed on Sunday that in order for someone to be a judge or a rabbi, he has to have smicha. He has to have been ordained by someone who was ordained, by someone who was ordained, going back to Moshe Rabbeinu. And that we no longer have that. So today, that's why you don't see that many batei dinim. You don't see that many courts set up. Because we no longer have this mitzvah, because we no longer have the judges like we once had. So by what right do judges judge today, if they're not ordained going all the way back to Moshe? So we have a special concept that's called Shlichusayu Avdina. We're their messengers. When they saw that we would no longer have any smicha, we would no longer have rabbis ordained the way we should, so they established a type of messengership. That the next generations are the messengers of the earlier generations that decided we need to have judges even though they won't be qualified like the Torah says. So they're not judging based upon what the Torah said. Our judges today do not have the biblical power to be judges. Their power stems from a social contract that was decided that they're our messengers. We've established them as judges. but it's they have less of a power. And that's why a lot of the laws of the Torah cannot possibly be judged today. That's why people today often say, we have to go back to a Torah society. We have to establish Batei Dinim. Everything has to go by the Torah. It's not that simple, because we don't have the power to judge things the way the Torah said, because we don't have the ordination of rabbis that the Torah requires in order for us to be judged. Yeah?
What's a smicha?
Smicha is when one is ordained rabbi by someone who was ordained by someone going all the way back to Moshe. Today we use the term smicha to mean one who's ordained rabbi by whatever tests we have today. But it's not the authentic smicha. It's today's smicha is a different thing. One who gets smicha today, he's a rabbi for whatever he's a rabbi today. But he doesn't have the smicha on the level that smicha really means. Smicha in the empirical sense is smicha going back till Moshe.
And it's a blessing?
No. It's initially it was that they placed the two hands on his head, but it's that they give him a license to be a judge or a rabbi. Today we have a smicha, we have a license to be a rabbi, but it's not the authentic smicha. A person needs smicha. If a person wants to rule on a question and his rabbi's in town, someone comes to him and says, you know, I was wondering, can I eat eggs with milk? So everyone knows that you're not allowed to eat meat with milk, but eggs, you're allowed to have eggs with milk, right? You're allowed to have scrambled eggs with cheese, everyone knows that. But his rabbi's in town, so he can't answer. There's a halacha that says you're not allowed to give ruling before your rabbi. Now, if your rabbi gives you smicha, so today's smicha, he's telling you, you know what, I let you give ruling. If people ask you halachic questions, you could answer them, even though I'm in town, or you could answer them in general. I can't answer questions unless my rabbi told me I'm fit to answer them. So different levels of smicha and different kinds of smicha. But today, that's basically what it shows, that I was ordained by my rabbi to give ruling.
I heard there's a way that they can restore the rules. They tried it, they haven't gotten it to...
Maimonides said that there's, if we get together the greatest rabbis, then we could renew the smicha. That was what the Rambam said. And then we could renew it. He says, even if we don't have direct lineage, if we get together the greatest rabbis, and we could reestablish it by putting together the greatest rabbis.
That is why we establish it in Sanhedrin.
And then we could reestablish the Sanhedrin and go from there. Correct. That's true. Not everyone agreed with the Rambam. In the time of the Beis Yosef, Rabbi Yosef Karo, there was an attempt to do that. The Torah forbids us to plant an asherah. What's an asherah? So, we don't know exactly what an asherah is. An asherah was some type of tree that they worshipped. Either they worshipped the tree, or they placed some kind of idol under the tree by its roots, and they'd bow down to that. So the Torah tells us we're not allowed to plant this type of idol. And the Torah tells us we're not allowed to plant any trees by the Har Habayis. One of the ways that they used to beautify their places of worship is they plant trees all around their cathedrals, and the Torah tells us don't make the Beis Hamikdash like that. The place where I'm worshipped shouldn't be like their places of worship. You don't plant trees. Another thing that the Torah does, the opposite from the idol worshippers, they always bow to the east, towards the sun. The Torah tells us the Holy of Holies is all the way on the west. We're always facing the west. The Kotel Ma'aravi is the western wall that was directly behind the Holy of Holies, because our holy place is to the west. So it's true today in the United States and in Europe, you pray to the east because that's where Jerusalem is. But the Torah always established our holy, the place of holiness is always to the west, the direct opposite of the idol worship. When our forefathers, the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, when they wanted to offer a sacrifice before God, they established what's called a matzeva. They took a huge rock and they used that as the altar. Now, the nations of the land started using huge rocks as their altars for idols. And God says, once it's used for idols, I don't like it anymore. It used to be that when people prayed, they'd open their hands wide and pray. And today, you don't see people doing that in shul. So it's not because they're scared of hitting the guy next to them. The reason is because in churches all over, they started establishing this as well. The people pray with their hands wide open. So because of that, just like the Torah tells us, God says, I don't want you to bring sacrifices on this type of altar because it's used for idol worship, so too, we don't pray to God that way because that's used for idol worship today as well. We're not allowed to bring before God an animal that has a blemish. What happens if we find someone that wants to serve another god? A man's wife decides she wants to serve idols. So we tell them, you know, you're not allowed to. And we warn them. The person that does this is punishable by death. You know, in Judaism, we don't kill unless the person was forewarned. And we bring witnesses and we say, look, if you're going to serve that idol, you're going to get killed. And if the person persists, then we take him to court and the people testify against him and he gets killed. He, she, whoever it is. Chazal tell us that we're supposed to look at the Torah at the juxtaposition of laws. It's not enough just to read the laws. Chazal tell us we have to ask ourselves, why are laws written next to one another? And Chazal often tell us why. Our sages tell us that why is the law of appointing judges directly near the law of serving idols? People think, you know, he's my friend, he's my neighbor, he's my brother, he's a good guy. Chazal say that if a person who's in charge of appointing judges doesn't do it 100% with the correct intent, then it's the equivalent of planting an idol. That's why the two are right next to one another. God says appoint good judges and don't plant trees that are for idol worship. And Chazal tells us that's to tell us that don't think that, he's also good. Doesn't work that way. You have to get the best judge. And when we go to court, so if we have a court case, then we have to search for the best possible court. Not for the court that's going to know me. If a court knows me, they might not even be able to judge the case. The Gemara tells us that a man came to one of the great rabbis and he wanted him to judge. He had a court case with someone. And he wanted him to judge, to be the judge there. So he came to the rabbi, and the rabbi was on his way out. So he helped the rabbi, he carried something for the rabbi. And he started talking to the rabbi, and then after a few minutes he told the rabbi, I want you to be a judge in this and this case. So he says, it's a pity. You should have told me that when you first came. I wouldn't have let you carry my whatever it was for me. Now that you carried something for me, I can't be a judge for you. You did something for me, right? Even something small, but I'm not going to be 100% impartial. I'll send you to this and this rabbi. The Gemara says this. He could be impartial for you. Go let him judge you. The Gemara says that that man came to that rabbi. And he said, you know, that big rabbi, Rabbi so-and-so, sent me. And when the second rabbi heard this, I said, boy, this must be a very important Jew. Now, sometimes in court, we know how to rule. And sometimes we have situations where the court says, I don't know. I can't rule in this situation. Fight it out. I can't get involved. I don't know. And sometimes we have situations where the court says, because I don't know, I have to say, we'll split it half-half. And sometimes we have situations where the court says, I don't know, but the court is entitled to say, who does it seem is saying the truth? The court looks and can make a call. So there are specific laws defining when the court has to say, I can't touch this, and when the court can say, we'll divide it, and when the court can say, he looks like he's saying the truth. So the Gemara tells us that this second rabbi sat in the court case, and when push came to shove, he said, I can't bring a ruling. This falls into the category where I have to make the call who it seems like is telling me the truth. And his heart swayed a little bit because he said, you know, this guy was sent to me by that great rabbi, must be he's a good person. And the Gemara tells us they were punished for that. That they were punished from heaven for not being 100% right. That first rabbi had nothing to do with this man. He met him for the first time when he came to his doorstep. That's the level of how the Torah holds us to be just people. When I was first studying to be a rabbi, so the rabbi I learned by, he told me the following story. He said, the Gemara tells us that there were two people being persecuted by the Romans. Two of our great rabbis were going to be put to death. And we know that the Romans tortured people when they put them to death. So they were discussing, what did we do that caused us to be put to death in such a painful manner? And one said to the other, could it be that once you ate and you ate a little bit more than you had to eat, and as a result of eating more, you slept a little bit longer, and someone came and they had a question to ask you, and you weren't there for them. Could it be? So then you weren't there to serve your people correctly. He told me that his father-in-law was on his deathbed, and people came to the door, they had questions to ask. And his wife said, no, he's got to rest. And he called his wife in, and he said, what am I here for? If I have a few hours or a few days to live, then my job is to answer people's questions. That's what I'm here for. So don't shoo anyone away. If there's a person that has a question, they have to come in and ask the question. The Torah holds anyone that's going to take a position of authority to the letter of the law, and on a very fine thread, the Torah looks at us whether we're right or wrong. And we all have that responsibility. If you walked into this yeshiva, then people are going to look at you differently. We just got an email from a guy who came only for a month. And the guy just emailed me. He said, you know, I came back to L.A. He's in L.A. now. Might even be watching us. He said, and all the people come back and they say, oh, you went to yeshiva. I got a question for you. Could you help me with my tefillin? Maybe they're not on right. Could you help me with this, that? You're going to leave yeshiva. You should know people are going to ask you questions. So you have to know what you know and what you don't know. But you also have to know that that holds you to a certain level of behavior. People are looking at you. You wear a yarmulke. You stand on line. People look at you. If you're going to cut that line, they're looking at you. You have a responsibility. The higher up you're going to go, the higher that responsibility. The Torah tells us the judges aren't allowed to take bribes. So that goes into the level, the guy carried the suitcase for you, that's a bribe. The Torah tells us that if we have a case where we don't know what the law is. We don't know. So the rabbis are discussing, is this okay, is this not okay? We have a court case, we don't know how to rule on it. We have a case where a person has a certain blemish, and we know that certain blemishes make a person impure, tzaras, something along the lines of leprosy, and certain blemishes are pure, and we're not sure where this color falls in. When a woman has her period, so she becomes impure, she and her husband have to separate until she stops menstruating, and then we count 7 days where she checks herself to make sure she's clean. Well, during those 7 days, she has a cloth with... She takes a new cloth every day, twice a day. She checks herself. She looks at the cloth and there's something on it. She's not sure. Is that blood? Isn't it blood? So one of the things the rabbis study is knowing how to discern what color is blood and what color isn't blood. So she sends her husband with the cloth and he brings it to the rabbi. And the rabbi looks at it and says, boy, this is borderline color. I'm not sure. Let me consult with the other rabbis. He brings that cloth. The other rabbis look at it. They say, we don't either know. It's borderline. So rabbis were always very careful, and to this day, if you go to a rabbi, then you should find a rabbi that can know you and answer you correctly. Rabbis are always very careful not to say that things are prohibited unless they have to. So just because I'm not sure, I can't say it's not good. I have to check it out. So the rabbis all have to take a journey up to Jerusalem to the high court and ask. They can't make a ruling when they're not 100% sure, so they ask about that cloth. They take the cloth up there and they say, is this blood or isn't it blood? Is this pure? Is it not pure? They go up to the journey to the high court and they ask him, how do we rule in this case? So the high court was sitting in the Beis Hamikdash, in our temple. And this shows us something about Jewish philosophy. The temple is not just the place where we worship God. It's the place where we're supposed to make peace between man and his friend. It's the place where God makes peace between man and his wife. The temple is the place where peace is supposed to come to the world. So the high court is sitting in the temple and they bring the question to the high court. Now the Torah says that the high court gives a ruling and we have to listen to them. What happens if there's a rabbi there? He's very smart, he knows a lot, and he starts arguing with them. So his job is to argue with them. He can't say, well, they said. It doesn't work that way. People today think, you know, I'll go to the rabbi, I'll ask him a question, he said, I could forget about it. If you have 10 reasons why you think otherwise, so tell him. You're supposed to tell the rabbi why, maybe not so. So this rabbi, he tells them all his reasons, and they say, no, nonetheless, the ruling is like this. He comes back to town, and people start asking the question again. Well, what's the ruling on this? And he tells them the other way. He goes again to the high court. So the law is that we bring him up to the high court again, and then we hold him in prison till all of Israel comes up to Jerusalem, the time of the regel, either Passover, Shavuos, or Sukkot, and then he's killed. Obviously, he's forewarned not to do this. This is, we discussed Sunday that the Torah gives power to the rabbis to define the Torah. Now, it could become open territory if a guy like Jesus could walk in and say, you know, I decided we should do things a little differently. You see what happened from that. So the Torah says there's a court, and the court rules how things should be, and no one's allowed to go against that court. And this is to maintain the truthfulness of the Torah. There is a way in which everyone has to go. Any questions? I'm not used to talking so much, really. I mean, guys who were here last year, I'm used to having more questions. Questions, whatever.
You were talking about the base of Mikdash, and they would have to bring the rug. If we had the base, if that's a requirement that everyone goes to the base of Mikdash to bring the sacrifice.
People are supposed to go on these three festivals. The Gemara explains how far away a person is to be required to go. There's a certain distance from where we say if he was further than that, he doesn't have the obligation to come up to the Beis HaMikdash during those three festivals. It's only within a certain circumference. The Gemara gives us which cities are the border cities.
Like everyone in Israel? Or
no, so that's what I'm saying. There are border cities. You have to be a certain distance from Jerusalem to be obligated to come up to the Beis HaMikdash for these holidays.
Okay.
I don't remember where the border is. I don't remember.
So if you're in America, you wouldn't have to fly?
From America, you wouldn't have to, but if you do, it's a good mitzvah, yeah. Now, there are four people. Okay, we'll leave that. The Torah says we have to listen to the high court. This pasuk that tells us we have to listen to the high court is the source for all mitzvos derabanan. We know that the Torah doesn't say anywhere we have to celebrate Hanukkah, right? Hanukkah was instituted by the rabbis at a later date. The Torah doesn't say we have to say Hallel on Rosh Chodesh. Yesterday we said Hallel, right? It doesn't say that in the Torah. So how do we make the blessing on all these mitzvos? Sher kiddushanu b'mitzvos v'tzivanu. We say God made us holy with his mitzvos and he commanded us to do the following things. God didn't command us, the rabbis commanded us. Where did they have power to command us from? So that all stems from this parsha, that the Torah says we have to listen to the high court, and that gives the rabbis the power to institute other things which we have to listen to them. We establish a king. We have three mitzvahs when we enter the land of Israel. One is to establish a king, the next is to fight Amalek, and the last is to build the Beis HaMikdash. We have to establish a king, and we have to respect him. We're not allowed to ride on his horse. We're not allowed to sit on his seat. We're not allowed to use his scepter. We're not allowed to wear his crown. We're not allowed to use his utensils. When he dies, we burn his utensils as a sign of honor that no one else is going to use it. And his servants can only be servants for the following, for another king. We're prohibited to anoint a king who is a non-Jew. Now that makes a lot of sense if you think about it. We didn't listen to this prohibition. In the time of the Second Temple, we established a non-Jewish king. Agrippas, with a whole dynasty of kings that weren't Jews. And that was a problem. God tells us not to go back to Egypt. God says the king shouldn't have a lot of horses, because if he has a lot of horses, then the source of good horses is Egypt, and he'll end up bringing the people back to Egypt to get more horses. So here we have the prohibition to go back to live in Egypt. Now we're allowed to go visit Egypt. I have a guy from the Machon right now doing scuba diving lessons in Egypt. Right? Still there? Yeah, okay. He's back? Okay, but that's okay. It says you're not allowed to go there to live. You're allowed to go there to visit. The king isn't allowed... What?
Not allowed to go visit.
You're allowed to visit Egypt. You're not allowed to go live in Egypt. I wouldn't recommend it. Safety isn't too great there, but the Torah permits it. The Rambam used to sign his letters, "I am the Rambam who transgresses three prohibitions every day because I am living in the land of Egypt." The Rambam wasn't living there because he had a choice. The Rambam ran there for his life and he didn't have a choice. And when he signed his letters, he didn't want people to learn from him. So we have manuscripts where the Rambam signed his name that way. He said, "I am the Rambam that every day of my life I am transgressing." What? I'm saying, so long as he lived there, he used to sign his name that way.
He could have gone somewhere else.
Obviously not. I mean, he wouldn't have stayed there. The Rambam spent years of his life in hiding. Everyone thought he was dead. The whole Mishnah Torah, the Rambam's great work, was written when everyone thought he was dead. He was wanted for his life, and they had him in hiding, and they set out word that he was dead. He couldn't go anywhere. He didn't see a human soul for years. He was in a closed room, and that's where the Rambam wrote the Mishnah Torah. He sat there learning, and he couldn't do anything. There were a few people who knew he was alive, and they brought him food. So I don't know the exact history. I don't remember where that was, if that was in Mitzrayim. But the Rambam wasn't always free to go wherever he wanted. Even as a kid, they almost killed him and his father. He spent a lot of his life on the run. He writes in one of his letters, he says, I'm sorry to disappoint you. You wrote in your letter, you heard I'm a big rabbi. Well, you're going to see that I'm not. But how could I be? He says, I spent so much of my life on the run. I was never able to learn properly. The Rambam writes that about himself. What? We don't know. The Rambam obviously felt if he weren't on the run, he'd do more. The king is limited. He's not allowed to have more than 18 wives. And he's not allowed to take on a wife that'll cause him to go the wrong way. So King Solomon, when he read this verse, he understood, you're not allowed to have too many wives because they'll cause you to go the wrong way. Well, I'll take good wives and I'm a smart man, so they won't lead me astray. Chazal tell us he messed up. That they did lead him astray. King Solomon, at the end of his days, his heart wasn't whole with his creator like it should have been because he had too many wives. The Torah gives us three commandments for a king.
What's a lot of living? Like David has 18.
18 is the limit. We learned from King David.
So
but that's the limit.
So
now. Wait. So we have to discuss today whether you're allowed to have more than one wife. That's a different discussion. Even in the times of the Gemara, we find that they usually had only one wife. Even from the time of creation, you hardly find that they had two wives. And when we find that they did have two wives, it's something that's mentioned as a derogatory fact. The fact that they took two wives, automatically our sages tell us they took one to have children and the other just to enjoy. Automatically our sages show us it was something that wasn't good. A person who's on King David's level could have 18 wives. He has the right intent when he has 18 wives. When he's in a problem, he has a problem with his health, that he needs to take on another wife, and they tell him that that's his only cure, that's what the doctors of the time advise him, so he says, well, I have one of two options. I could divorce one of my wives and take her, but if he divorces her, she can't marry anyone else because a king's wife could only marry another king. A king's wife can't even marry another king. She can't marry anyone else. So King David is in a situation where he's freezing. They can't heat him up, and they tell him the only cure for this sickness is to take on another wife, and that wife will be a virgin, and that's the way he'll be warmed. And this is what the doctors of the time advise him. And he says, well, I'm not going to take on another wife because I can't pain any of my wives to divorce them just because I'm an old man who's freezing. So he figures out another way of getting around it. But he doesn't hurt his wives because a person on the right level, his wife, he recognizes, is the most precious thing he has. We discussed this already, that when King David was offered to get the whole kingdom, but his wife was taken away from him, he said, I'm not interested in the kingdom. Give me my wife, then I'll talk about the kingdom. The king is commanded to listen to the prophets. Our first king, King Saul, he fell with that point. He didn't listen to the prophet. The prophet told him, wait till I come till you offer a sacrifice. And he was pressured. It was a time of war, and he didn't. And that's why he lost his kingdom. The king is told if he listens to the Torah, then his offsprings will be kings after him, and otherwise they won't. King Saul didn't listen. He didn't listen to the prophet, and that's why his sons... We don't see the dynasty continuing from Saul. I want to skip a little bit because we're almost out of time. Is there any point in the parsha that specifically interests anyone? We have 5 minutes left. Yeah?
What?
Ravi, yeah. Right.
Can you explain that?
Yeah. The Torah says that Kohanim have have a right, their obligation is to bring the sacrifices for the Jewish people. Now, the Torah also says that a Kohen could come whenever he wants to bring his own sacrifice. So that leaves room for a lot of trouble, because which Kohanim are going to be there serving all the time? So the Torah gives us a right to sell our rights as Kohanim to bring the sacrifices. And that's what was done in King David's time. King David divided the Kohanim into 24 families, and each family had a week when they were responsible, and each family was divided into days, and the families were divided into smaller sections of families, and each family was responsible for a specific day. Now this division, that this family is responsible for this week, and they get all the sacrifices this week, that division the Torah gives us permission to do here. That's what King David did. He established 24 watchings, they're called mishmaros in Hebrew, watchings, that the Kohanim were divided into 24 sets of families that would bring, each one had their week when they were responsible. And this, the Torah gives us power to do here, that Kohanim could sell their rights to one another. Anything else? Yeah?
About establishing a king, doesn't it say somewhere else in the Tanakh that, like, king is a bad king?
Yes. So it's true that when the Jewish people asked for a king, God was very upset at them for asking for a king. And that question is addressed. If we look closely at the psukim over there, the prophet tells us that the reason was because they didn't want a king for the reasons God tells us to have a king. King has a job to ensure the smooth running of society. The court system is very limited. We didn't get to it, but the parasha says, what happens if one person hates another person? So we know there's enmity between the two. We know there's adverse relations between the two of them. And suddenly, by mistake, he kills him. So we don't have witnesses, and he wasn't warned. So the court system can't do anything. So the halacha says that that's where a king has to get involved. The king's job is to enforce the law where the law can't enforce itself. The law has limitations to ensure that the justice system isn't taken advantage of. But what happens with things that the justice system can't take care of? So that's where a king enters the picture. The king's job is to lead us to war, and the king's job is to ensure that people don't take advantage of the justice system. Now, the Jewish people, when they asked for a king, they weren't asking for a king because they wanted that. They came and they said, we want to be like all the nations of the world. We don't want these prophets leading us, telling us what to do, telling us to abide by the Torah. We want to distance ourselves a little bit from God. Let us have a king. And because their approach was one of distancing themselves from God, they didn't want to be led by prophets anymore, that's why God was upset at them for asking for a king. I think we're out of time. Thursday night, hopefully we're going to have